8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. There's something so special about exploring memoirs, and especially a memoir which is as well written as the one we're exploring today, and one that tells as complex and fascinating a story as the one we're exploring today, a book titled I'm Still Here. It is written by Martina Reeves, and it is the story of her life and some of the complex challenges and unexpected twists and turns that life has taken over the last decades, including her bouts with cancer, more than one. But this is far more than just a cancer survivor story, although that in and of itself would be a very compelling story. It's also the story of Martina Reeves, in a sense, finding her way into the world and building for her a family that means all the world to her, and coming to terms with the world around her and tumultuous world events and national events as well. There is a lot packed into the pages of this disarmingly honest and open memoir, which is published by She Writes Press. Again, it's titled, I'm Still Here. And Martina Reeves, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
I'm glad that we can have this conversation. One of the things that your biography says is that you were a lawyer who hated practicing law. And in the memoir, you do touch on this just a little bit, but I think right off the bat, it would be interesting for our listeners to hear just a little bit about why you would say such a thing, and maybe how that ties into who you are and the kind of memoir that you have written.
Well, that's a good question. No one's asked me that. Well, I became a lawyer because I was a product of the 60s and the 70s, and I wanted to make a difference. And I thought being a female lawyer at the time I went to law school would be a big deal. In the county I came from, there were only two female lawyers. One worked for legal services and one had a private practice. So I went off to law school not really having a clue how that would be. And I loved it. I loved being in school. I loved using that part of my brain. But being a lawyer was a different sort of thing. I think I'm not naturally an adversarial person, although I would say a lot of people would dispute that about me. But I didn't like the whole charade of going to court and speaking a certain way and glad handing and getting along with all these people and speaking in an inauthentic way. And that's what it was like for me going to court. I was a wreck every time I had to go, a wreck. I'd have to go home and completely change my clothes before I went back to work because I was just a wreck. And so I kept thinking I'd get used to it. The advice was, oh, at 5 years, you'll be fine. Well, at 5 years, I wasn't fine. Actually, at 5 years, I got cancer the first time. And I had a new baby who was 3 months old. And I never went back to adversarial law.
You did do work as a mediator, and we'll explore that too, because I think you write so perceptibly about what that was like. Something else that you mentioned in your biography, and it comes up more than once in your memoir, is the fact that you grew up in a Navy family, and you lived in more than 30 different homes over the course of maybe not even that many years. I forget, but you give us the specific numbers, the specific math, but it's really kind of astonishing. And it's not just during those years with your family moving as your father was, I suppose, deployed to different places, but even as you grew into adulthood, you had, in a sense, kind of this restlessness, or maybe it was life circumstances. But what kind of difference do you think that has made in terms of all of the places that you lived for so much of your life? What did that contribute to who you are and, in a sense, to how you view yourself and the world around you?
Well, when I was growing up, I didn't mind moving until I got up to high school. And then I was much more attached to my friends. And when I ended up going to three different high schools, it was very traumatizing to leave my friends. But up until then, it was sort of like an adventure to be in a new place, to meet new people, to have new friends. I won't say, looking back on it, that it was good for me. You know, I don't think I realized the impact it had on me until my current relationship and living in the house I'm living in now for 35 years. Because now I see how you attach to a place and put down roots and watch children grow and watch people die and take care of your neighbors and have these connections that I did not have growing up. I had to rely pretty much on my family. They were the only constant. Sometimes there were other Navy families that we would be in the same place with once or twice. But basically everything was new: teachers, community, school, friends, every 1 to 3 years. And the only constant was my family. That's a big burden for a family. It's something I don't recommend. I think I was pretty strong about living in a place that would be good for my son and staying put. Now, I might have moved houses were it not for my wife, but she is a homebody and she was not about to move out of this house. So I credit her with actually being in this house for 35 years. But now that I've been here, I really see the value that you get from being part of a community.
One of the things I said at the outset is I think I said something to the effect that this is a disarmingly open, honest memoir, and you are open about yourself, and you are open about others, including your family, with whom you've, from time to time, had very contentious relationships, and wife Tanya and her parents, there's also been a great deal of contentiousness there as well, in part because the two of you became a couple at a time when much of the world was not ready for that in the way that more of the world is ready for that now, of course. But so it's not much of a surprise that there was the difficulty that you experienced with your family. Talk for a moment about choosing to be so honest, so frank about your family, your relationship with them. And was that a difficult choice to make, to be that open in this memoir?
The advice I got from my mentor and writing teacher was, write what's true, and if you publish, you can take things out if you don't want them there. I did that. So I just wrote what was true for me in a series of what I thought in the beginning were just short stories about my life. And it wasn't that hard. I think I'm like that as a person. I'm pretty honest about how I feel and what I think as a person. And it wasn't that hard to write it. I had pause talking about some things about my mother, but by the time it got to the point that we were getting ready to publish, my mother was in her late 90s and had, you know, early dementia at that point. And I wasn't worried. I'd bring her stories to read and she wouldn't even read them. I mean, she just couldn't take it in. So I think there's nothing harmful about the truth most of the time. So it wasn't a choice. It was what, sort of a compulsion.
Right.
It was true.
It's what you had to do. And I, for one, am glad you did it, because it's part of what makes this memoir so fascinating. And if you had treaded carefully as if over eggshells, I think it would be a very different book and probably less of a book. What was the reason for writing the book in the first place? You've already touched on what I think is the fact that it perhaps began as just a number of different stories that eventually found their shape as a memoir. But when you began writing in that fashion, was it to serve any particular purpose?
I'd always wanted to write. It was like a fantasy, really, that I would be sitting at a desk looking out a window like I am right now over a scene of trees and things, and I would write. But mostly what I did was read and work and do what you do in life to take care of business. And in the mid-2000s, I got a catalog from the UC Berkeley Extension, and it had a course called Writing Fiction from Life Experience. And I thought, wow, that is a great idea. I'm going to take that class. So with great fear and trepidation and anxiety, I signed up for this class and went, knowing nothing about writing. Even though I thought I knew a lot about it, I realize now I knew very little. But I was thrilled with this class. I loved this class. And then I saw a class in memoir, and I was too fearful to do that in person. So it was an online class. And I did that class. And the teacher was encouraging. So then the next class I took was called Creative Nonfiction. And that's where I met the person, David Schweidel, who's been my mentor all these years. And between the time I signed up for his class in December and January of 2008, I was diagnosed with tongue cancer. And I went to the class anyway. And I wrote about the cancer and I wrote about my life. I had intended to write about my family, because I read all this fiction and there were never any credible lesbian or gay characters. This was like 2008. And I just thought we should be peopled in fiction. And I thought I would write the story of our family as a memoir, because it's kind of fun. And my son looked up his donor father and we're part of a big extended family, and we have a bunch of half sisters and a half brother and all that now. So I thought it would be fun to write that. I mean, now that's all over the news, but in 2008, it really wasn't that in the news. So I just wrote stories all the way through the cancer. And at the end, I had this big pile of stories, and my teacher said, I think you have a book. And that's how it came about. You know, I printed them all up and spread them out on the floor and figured out how they might go together. It took 8 years.
Wow. One choice you made is that this memoir is, and I don't mean this as a criticism, it's complicated in that you are forever jumping between different time frames and different places, and also without headings. So it's, in a sense, kind of left to the reader to sort out that, oh, now we're back in such and such, and now we're here, or now we're there. And it actually makes the book just that much more fun to explore. But of course, not all memoirs are written that way. Is there some particular reason why you thought your story and this memoir would be better served by crafting it in this way, without the kind of smooth chronological arc that some memoirs feature?
Well, at one point I did put the stories in chronological order, and it was so boring. It was shockingly boring. And when you got to the cancer part of the story, it became tedious. And so I learned there's this thing called a braided memoir, in which you have two timelines. And I realized I had that. I had the timeline from when I moved to San Francisco in 1969 at age 20, which is where the memoir starts. And then I had the timeline that starts in January 2008, when I got cancer the second time. And then, so then I set about braiding those two together. So it's pretty much every other chapter throughout the book. At times I had dates. Originally I had dates. And then I tried to weave into the beginning of each chapter what the time was, so people, the reader, would know fairly quickly which timeline we were on. Then when I got to She Writes Press, my editor there, Brooke Warner, told me to take out all the childhood chapters. So there were 75 pages of my childhood that came flat out of the memoir, which was a little, you know, they were my darlings. They were my first pieces of writing, but it was the right decision. Three timelines would have just driven readers nuts.
I'm so glad to know. That was one of the next questions I was going to ask you, is the fact that we learn actually rather little about your childhood in this memoir. And I wondered if that was a conscious choice on your part, or if for some other reason your childhood is largely absent from this memoir. So it's good to have at least something of an answer to that. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Martina Reeves about her memoir called I'm Still Here. And this is a story that chronicles much of her adult life, which included a marriage to a man, later a marriage to a woman, having a son, and contending with cancer, not once, but twice, and shaping all of that together into what is a really riveting memoir that I have thoroughly enjoyed writing, reading. So I want to give you a chance to talk about Tanya, with whom you have shared much of your life. One of the things I've found really interesting about it is when you characterize some of your early years with Tanya as lesbian high drama. And you know, it's an interesting term. Would be highly insulting if it came from an outsider, but of course it's you talking about your own life with your wife Tanya. So Can you just say a word about your choice to use a term like that to describe your early years, and in what ways is it fitting?
Well, it was so not worth writing about those years. They were so ridiculous. They were like a soap opera. We'd be together, we'd break up. We'd be together, we'd break up. We did that enough times that I couldn't even count them probably on one hand. And finally, when I thought we'd broken up for good and we hadn't seen each other for 6 months, I grew up a little bit. I graduated from law school. I got a real job. I got my own apartment and lived by myself for the first time in my whole life. And I had an idea what it had felt like to her, who was already a lawyer, to be around this hysterical law student who was trying to finish law school and internships and take the bar and go through a divorce. And, you know, I was kind of a hot mess. Why would anyone want to be with me? So we spent 6 months apart. And I heard she wasn't doing very well and that she blamed herself for our relationship not working. And I thought, oh no, she shouldn't do that. Really, I was a big part of it. And my self-righteousness was absurd. So I called her up and invited her to come to my new little apartment for dinner. And we got back together, but we didn't tell anybody for 3 months. Because we knew they wouldn't want to hear about it again. So that we're celebrating that anniversary on March the 2nd, tomorrow. It will be 38 years since we got back together for good, but we sort of count the beginning part because it's all part of one big making a relationship.
One big adventure. Whoops. Tell our listeners about your very first encounter with Tanya. An unpromising beginning.
Oh, unpromising. We are very different from each other in many, many ways. So when I met her, I was in law school and I drove commuter buses to make a living while I was in law school because my husband made too much money. $10,000 was all he made, but it was too much for me to get work study. So I had to work my way through law school. And I'd get up at 5 a.m. and go pick up my bus and fuel it with diesel fuel and pick up my commuters and drive into the financial district and park my bus and drive up the walk up the hill to the California Street office of my very impeccable, perfect, obnoxious employer. And I was his first hire beyond clerical staff, and I did research for him. So one day he invited me to an office meeting at 8 a.m. It was 90 degrees that day in San Francisco, and I arrived. I was just a mess. You know, it was hot. I'd been driving a bus. I'd spilled diesel fuel on myself. I had on my bus driver uniform, and all the people in the office were people who went to EST, which was a personal growth rage in California at that time, which I utterly despised. And they were perfect. They didn't sweat. They were clean. They had on their fancy office clothes. And there I am, droopy. And he says he's hired this new lawyer to work with him. And she's going to come in right now. And she makes this grand entrance into his office. She's this petite little thing wearing a cashmere sweater dress in 90 degree heat. We had AC, of course, in the office. And she had long blonde hair down to the middle of her butt and a southern accent. And then he told me I was going to work with her. And I just thought, oh my God, no. I thought they were all S graduates and that we had to do the kind of talk that S people did, which was about, you know, being personally fulfilled, and we shared and we created a world where there was no hunger just by thinking about it. That's what the S people did in those days. So Tanya walked in and seemed like one of them and flashed this big smile and said, it's such a great opportunity to be here. And I was ready to die that I had to work with her. My law school was a progressive, left-wing law school that was creating lawyers who were supposed to change the world. And here was this testament to what we were trying to change.
A Southern Belle.
A Southern Belle. Oh my God. It took me about 2 or 3 months to learn that she was a lesbian. I had no idea. And it took her 2 or 3 months to realize I was married to a man. She had no idea. And when we figured that out about each other, we also figured out that she hated Est as much as I did. And we started sneaking off from the office to drink cappuccino and talk about how awful our jobs were. So that was our beginning. We were really good friends. And there was no hint of falling in love and living happily ever after at all. We socialized with my husband and her partner at the time and didn't have a clue until much later that we were, you know, we were more than friends, as we say.
You do write about your first marriage to your husband, David, and the multiple reasons why that marriage ultimately disintegrated. What did it feel like to revisit what I'm sure was, especially towards the end, a really difficult period in your life?
I liked telling the story. It's true that there was a period of time that was really difficult with him at the end. But I don't regret my time with him. He gave me a lot of safety and a lot of room to be who I wanted to be. He was very supportive of my going to law school. And we had some really wonderful adventures together. But toward the end of our relationship, he got involved with a type of Christianity, you know, evangelical Christianity, and speaking in tongues and things like that, that didn't really resonate with me. When we had been together, he had been a Christian, but he and an Episcopal priest in the past, but he had been very political and involved with liberation theology. And now all of a sudden he was a born again Christian. And it just was not the direction I was moving in at all. I was going to a very political law school, a feminist, and was pretty clear if I weren't with him, I would be with women. I wouldn't say that I thought I was a lesbian. I figured that I love whoever I love, but I was very committed to being with him and not leaving him. And then it all fell apart. We had an open marriage. It didn't work. We called it off. then he had an affair with a Christian woman. And it was just obviously, there was too much to try to stay together.
Right. Well, it, in a sense, it gives your life and this memoir such texture to think about having that marriage experience, and then ultimately the marriage experience that you've had with your wife, Tanya. I mean, poles apart in so many ways, and yet you are the through line. And it's just fascinating to compare those two relationships and the reality of them. And of course, you are with Tanya at a point in time that is not like the landscape that we find ourselves in today. Not that there isn't still pockets of resistance, but by and large, we're living in a world now where there are not all that many people troubled by your kind of relationship. But at this point in time, you had family members deeply troubled by this. What was it like at that point in time? And how did the two of you weather what had to be one of the most challenging aspects of pursuing your love for each other, feeling such resistance from both of your families?
Well, we were living in San Francisco. We thought we were on top of the world. This was before AIDS. Lesbians and gay men ruled. You know, it was just a wonderful time to be in San Francisco, and everybody had their family story. And most of us didn't care that much. Mm. I knew my father would be thrown for a loop, and I also knew he would come around. And we pretty much knew that Tanya's family wouldn't. You know, they're all from Texas, and the younger generation did. The nieces and nephews are totally fine. And Tanya's mother lives with us now. I mean, her mother was always great.
Huh.
But her father was very, very opposed to our being together and to our having Cooper. My father was opposed to us having Cooper. But when he was a month old, he was up here on an airplane to meet his grandson. These Southern men have a way of overlooking things and compartmentalizing when they love you. And my father did love me. Hmm. I caused him a lot of grief as a teenager. And then after I came out, I know I caused him a lot of grief. But I also know he loved me and he adored Tanya. So in the end, it all turned out. One of my brothers was, I always sort of thought David wasn't right for you. And my other brother I wrote about, he was in China at the time studying acupuncture, and he did have a hard time with it at first. But we were in San Francisco having the time of our lives.
That's a good thing to remind everyone. You were not living in Norfolk, Nebraska. You were in San Francisco, California.
No, we were out as we could be and, you know, taken over in politics and just vibrant and creative. And it was a wonderful time to be gay and lesbian.
Before we move into some other aspects of your story, we should talk for a moment about having your son Cooper. And you talk about several different options that were available to you in terms of having a child, and the option that you ultimately chose, which turned out about as beautifully as it possibly could have turned out. Explain to our listeners how you and Tanya were able to have Cooper, and what your life together has been like.
We were both lawyers at the time, and the law was in a state of flux in terms of the non-biological mom, the sperm donor, all of that. And so there were cases where friends of a lesbian couple would donate sperm and then meet the baby and want to be part of raising the baby, and courts would let the sperm donor do that. And so while we thought we might know men who would donate sperm, we thought about it a long time and thought we did not want to have to deal with any legal issues. Then a lot of women were just getting pregnant on their own with donor sperm, but not going to a sperm bank. And the state of the law when we were doing it was that if you did it through a certain way, which included a sperm bank, then the donor would have no legal rights. And we thought that was the best way for us to go. So first we went to the sperm bank in Berkeley, which was the most excruciating experience. It was horrible. We went in the door and there were all these heterosexual couples sitting around, and they kind of looked at us like we were freaks. We were kind of cute in those days. You know, we were in our 30s and we were very good looking women, but we were two women together and we did look probably like we were lesbians. They probably had gaydar, all those straight couples in that room. And the secretary was just absolutely contemptuous of us. No privacy. You know, we were asking just how does it work and can we get some information? And she was talking in a really loud voice. And she handed us a printout that had the sperm donor's number, hair color, eye color, ethnicity and race, and profession, I think. That was it. That was all the information we were going to get. And we slinked out the door and thought, God, we have to figure out a better way to do this. Then we heard about this woman named Sharon Mills in San Francisco, who is a nurse practitioner, and she was beginning to open a small sperm bank for lesbians who wanted to be parents. And we were among her first clients. She had these nice, big, long interview sheets from the sperm donors. We could have hired a private investigator and found our donor in a flash. We knew a lot about him when we picked him. And we picked him because the secretary told us he was a really nice, kind man, which is all we really wanted. So I got inseminated and got pregnant the first time I tried, which was just absolutely miraculous. I had never gotten pregnant the whole time I was with my husband. We'd never tried. We didn't want to have kids until at one point I did and he didn't. So we used birth control religiously. And the moment I tried to get pregnant, I got pregnant. It was just fabulous.
And one of the things I appreciate about you describing parenting Cooper is how both you and Tanya, in some sense, felt like you were in a bit of a fishbowl, because this was at a time when it was not particularly common for a lesbian couple to be raising a child. And you talk at certain points about how you're so afraid that every time Cooper might get into some kind of trouble or some serious issues might arise, people might think, if only he had a father in the home. You're very honest about some of those feelings of, I suppose, kind of vulnerability that you felt, but we should leap ahead to say that it all worked out beautifully, and Cooper's a great young man, and all of you, including his biological father, whom he eventually met, you're all very, very close and the most wonderful family one could wish for.
It did work out. It did. But in hindsight, I really wish I'd been more relaxed. I felt very much like we were in the forefront and had to present a good picture he was, there were two lesbian families in his elementary school when we started. When he went to kindergarten, there were the two of us and Cooper, and there was another couple, but only one of them was an original mom to the child, and it wasn't obvious they were a lesbian couple at first to us. So we felt like we had to write to the teachers and say, this is who our family is. These are our names. This is what Cooper calls us. Just explain how to deal with us. So there was definitely a way in which I felt that pervasive thinking on many people's parts that a boy needed a father. It was pervasive in the family law community, for example. And that was the community I was in at that point. I had not started doing mediation. I was a family lawyer, and here I was, having a child and depriving him of a father. I'm sure there were many people who had judgment about that. And then there were a lot of lesbians who thought lesbians shouldn't raise children, that we should be fixing the world, not doing this mother job. So all in all, it was not what I would call a super friendly environment, but we moved into this house when he was 6 months old, and the people across the street who had a daughter a year older than Cooper, a heterosexual couple, enveloped us into their arms and their family. Mm. And everyone treated us fine in the neighborhood. So we had lots of really good luck along the way, along with this internalized stuff that I had going on, and Tanya too. We both, the best story we tell about him is going to a birthday party at Jamie's house. Jamie was his black friend who lived around the corner, and they really liked each other. He was the only white kid invited to Jamie's birthday party, and all Jamie's relatives were there. Their house was packed. There must have been 50, 60 people there. And it was time for Cooper to, they told us, you know, the party goes till 5 or whatever, and Tanya went over to pick him up, and Cooper didn't want to leave. And he was a stubborn, strong kid. Tanya had to throw him over her shoulder and carry him up through the living room through all these relatives. And she came home and she thought, oh my God, these people are thinking lesbians don't know how to raise a boy. He was so outrageous. Jamie would never think of behaving that way, you know? So what can I say? It was a challenge sometimes.
My favorite story is when he was on the wrestling team at his school, and for the matches, he would only want one of you to be there, not the two moms, because, you know, in his mind, that was a place and that was an arena in which that just wasn't going to be very well received. And so it's like Cooper also played a part in helping the three of you navigate all of this. Well, it's interesting and surprising to me that we've found so much to talk about. And here, as we approach the end of the interview, we've scarcely touched on the fact that you are a cancer survivor twice. And much of your memoir deals with contending with cancer and on all kinds of different levels, logistically and medically and so on. We will mostly be leaving it to our listeners to explore this part of your powerful story. Could you just say a word about what it was like to relive what I am assuming would be the most difficult facet of your life, And to any extent, was it cathartic, or did the process of writing about it help you make sense of it, or was it just a story that needed to be told, no matter how painful the process might be for you?
Well, I wrote it, the first drafts of it, as I was going through it. And once I revised them the first time, I stuck them in a drawer. And when I pulled them back out, they were probably three times as long as what's in the book, maybe five times as long. And I had to read them over and over and whittle away to get down to the essence of each story. And it was hard. You know, there were some dark moments. The chapter about the rats, every time I read it, I can barely get through it.
This is a chapter where you talk about how your apartment is, in a sense, kind of infested with rats. And this is at the same time that you are desperately battling cancer. And it becomes, in a sense, almost a metaphor for battling back against cancer. And the victory in the one almost feels like a victory in the other. It's really something. So what did you ultimately gain from sharing this painful part of your life?
Well, the truth is, a lot of the cancer experience was very joyful. I don't think of my book as depressing. It's part of the difficulty in promoting it, is that people hear what it's about and think, "Yeah." Mm. You know, it's gotten prizes, but the prizes are in things like grief and death and dying and cancer. And a lot of people don't think of that as being uplifting in any way. I admit that chapter about the rats is heavy, but most of the book is not so heavy, I don't think.
And I think you're right that even as you talk about the cancer, it is often through a lens of humor and insight. And I think you're absolutely right. This is not nearly as dreary a memoir as one might assume when they hear that cancer is one of the things you talk about. And was that a conscious decision to write about it in that way?
No, that's how it was. That was my lived experience of having immense intimacy with the few close friends and family that I had the energy for. A lovely connection with nature. And a lot of interesting healing experiences with people from very different backgrounds than mine. So I didn't experience my time with cancer as this big black hole for 2 years. There were moments that were black holes, but mostly I was living. Mm. And it was intense and beautiful and intimate and not a horrible thing.
Well, and that says a lot about how these stories impact us as we read them. I think you're absolutely right. And it's probably one of the reasons why you survived it and thrive to this very day. And so I'm grateful that you have told the story as you have. The memoir, again, is titled I'm Still Here, published by She Writes Press, and the author, Martina Reeves. Martina Reeves, I congratulate you on a beautifully crafted and endlessly interesting memoir, and I am appreciative of you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you so much. I'm happy that we got to talk.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Richard Gunderman talks about his fascinating book, Contagion, which explores the history of humankind's contention with various pathogens and plagues. His book, Contagion, Plagues, pandemics, and cures from the Black Death to COVID-19 and beyond has just been published.